The Economic Year in Review, Interest Rates Edition, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 19th day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. 2019 has been, among many other ways you could describe it, a year of economic twists and turns. The USMCA is all but a done deal. It passed the House today. So too, in theory, is that Phase 1 agreement with China. Over at the Federal Reserve, kind of the same thing. Four interest rate increases last year, a U-turn to three cuts this year. Most of the time, we can only speculate about what's going on inside the central bank. There are other times, though, like, oh, I don't know, today, when we can just ask. Neel Kashkari is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Also, starting in January, as part of the Fed's regular rotation, he will be a voting member of the Interest Rate Setting Federal Open Market Committee, which is relevant because Kashkari has been saying for years now that lower interest rates are the way to go. Neel, it's good to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So look, the Federal Open Market Committee, on which, as I said, you will be a voting member next year, has finally decided to start seeing things your way. What happened?
Well, I think we've all been surprised over the last few years how many more Americans wanted to work who weren't being counted. You know, the unemployment rate only counts people who are actively looking for work. And as that rate fell lower and lower, we thought, well, maybe we're getting the full employment. Turns out we weren't. A lot of people came off the sidelines. So the economy is growing. People are finding jobs. That's really good news. And I'm happy that the committee recognized this and we adjusted monetary policy because of it.
Let me put it another way. Is it possible that the Federal Reserve has been wrong all these years about what this economy could sustain, what inflation could bear, what the labor market could bear, and have now seen the error of your ways?
I think we have been wrong. I think we've been wrong exactly what you said, that we can put people to work and have wages grow, and it doesn't necessarily lead to inflation, at least not yet. So let's let the economy continue to run. The American people will benefit from it, and I'm glad we're doing that.
You say continue to run. Is there room to cut rates even more in the coming year?
Well, right now we're in a kind of a pause mode, but I would say if the economy looked like it was slowing down or the job market started to slow down, I would probably be in the camp of, yes, let's give it more support to try to bring more workers back in. I mean, putting people to work, helping them put food on the table for their families, it's just good news. We need to let this continue.
So we had a conversation. I had a conversation with Neel Irwin of the New York Times about a week, 10 days ago, a piece he wrote for the paper, in which he, in essence, said the costs of the Fed's miscalculation have been enormous, right? We would have had more people working. We would have had better standards of living for those people. All of those things that goes along with more people employed in this economy. Why should we trust you, I guess, is the question.
Well, I can tell you this. My colleagues and I at the Federal Reserve are committing to try to make the best decisions we can to achieve the goals that Congress has given us. We're not perfect. We're going to make mistakes. But the good news is we recognize it when we make a mistake and we adjust. And I give our chairman, Jerome Powell, terrific credit for recognizing that we had, you know, over-tightened, and he's led the committee to cut rates and provide more support to the economy.
I don't want to get in. I truly don't want to get into the, oh, my God, the president is criticizing the Fed and all of this. But to what effect have the Federal Open Markets Committee's decisions the past 18 months been skewed by the president's trade policy? In essence, the Fed rescuing the economy from the president of the United States.
Well, we hear when I travel around my region, we hear from a lot of farmers and from exporters that they've been really nervous about the trade wars and the tariffs, and they've pulled back on some of their investments. And so that's been having an effect on the economy. And I think that that has contributed to our own assessment of the economic outlook. But also the labor market, as we just talked about for the last couple of minutes, has exceeded our expectations. I think all of those together were involved in helping drive the Federal Reserve's decision making.
Last thing, Neel, and then I'll let you go. It's easy to look at this from the outside and say, wow, the Fed, I mean, there's a shift going on here. They're really changing the way they're thinking about this economy. Is that the way it feels inside the room?
It does. It does to me. I mean, a year ago, last December, we had just raised rates and we were forecasting multiple more rate increases to come. Here we are a year later. We've cut interest rates instead three times, and we've basically forecast that we're on pause for the foreseeable future. That is a profound shift from where we were, and I think it's really good news for the labor market, for the economy, and I'm really happy that we've done it.
Neel Kashkari is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, also come January, a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee. Neel, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time, as always.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
On Wall Street today, impeachment, schmimpeachment. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a big data release from the Census Bureau today, specifically something called the American Community Survey, part of it anyway. It is the source of demographic data about this economy and the people in it, of which the thread we pulled today is education, specifically this item. From 2011 to 2018, the number of people enrolled in school in the United States, any kind of school, fell by more than 2 million people, the biggest chunk of which was college enrollment. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports on why Americans are choosing to forego certain types of higher education.
Work or study? Working makes money. Getting a degree takes money, at least at first. More Americans are choosing work.
The economy explains most, if not all, of the decline in enrollment.
Diane Schanzenbach heads the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern. When it's hard to get jobs, more people take refuge in the educational system. They want to increase their chances of getting a job. That's what happened during the recession.
Between 2007 and 2010, we saw an increase of 15% in college enrollment.
That was massive, and now we're seeing the opposite. It's the best labor market in a half century. College seems a little less necessary to get a job.
Now that the economy has turned around, we're seeing fewer people go to college.
But we're not so much talking about high school students deciding to skip college. We're talking mostly about older people deciding not to go back to college or to a two-year degree program to touch up their skills. These are the people who would have to give up a paycheck to go back to college. Lisa Barrow is a senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago.
People think about tuition, but the biggest source of cost is foregone earnings.
In a good economy, more people are happy with the gig they have. With some exceptions, the number of graduate students rose 8% between 2011 and 2018. Why? Also money-related. Again, Diane Schanzenbach.
Wage growth has been historically quite strong for people with graduate degrees.
People go where the money is. Sometimes that's through the labor market, and sometimes that's through more time on campus. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
All right, so keep that story in the back of your mind while you listen to this next one. If education is the key, or really one of the keys to success, then what do you make of a report out today from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that says middle market businesses, which are companies with revenues between $10 million and $1 billion, it says those companies are having trouble finding skilled workers. That's been a problem for a while, the Chamber says, and the big picture labor force question to be asked here as a result of it is, how does one go from worker to skilled worker? Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that one.
Every worker has some kind of skill, even doing inventory at a knick-knack shop, which was my first job. But what's a skilled worker?
Typically, what people mean is some kind of specialized skill that requires some higher education credentials or some specific training.
That's Heidi Scheerholt, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. The jobs she's talking about include coding and IT, but also,
you know, skilled manufacturing jobs and skilled construction jobs. So you can see these kinds of skills in traditionally blue-collar jobs.
Like woodworking, for example. Tony Sandkamp owns a custom woodworking business in New Jersey.
Employees that are highly skilled as cabinet makers and woodworkers are highly desirable and very difficult to get a hold of.
Sandkamp says he gets lots of job applications, but not from people with the right skills. And that means he's had to fight to keep the workers he has.
I don't want to lose somebody, so that will push up wages.
And that kind of competition is having an effect across the economy. Wages are up 3.1% from last year. The skills shortage is also pushing some companies to hire relatively unskilled workers and then train them, says Elizabeth Crawford, senior economist at the Conference Board.
So what they're having to do is lower their requirements in terms of education, skill, and experience in order to get these people into the door.
Crawford says for employers, it's a perfect storm. The labor force isn't growing fast enough, and skills aren't keeping up with demand. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Here's today's seemingly random but still relevant and, as a bonus, kind of amusing at the same time, economic policy data point. We've been reporting the past week or so on the subsidy program the Trump administration has rolled out, the Market Facilitation Program, MFP it's called, that's meant to help farmers get back some of what they're losing because of his trade war. We went out to Iowa. We filed a big Freedom of Information Act request as well, within which is this line item. You know how the attention and the money has mostly been on soybeans, like in the billions of dollars? Yeah, we'll get this. Hazelnut farmers got some support as well. $435 in total. $435. There was, though, I like that stat. I just got to tell you. There was, though, a whole lot of other data in that FOIA request, data that was analyzed and visualized by our colleagues at the APM Research Lab, where Andy Egbert works. Andy, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Kai.
So we had the $435 for the hazelnut farmers, but obviously a much bigger program. Would you give me sort of the top line data on this thing?
Yeah, well, we examined the data set from September of 2018 through November 1 of this year. And this market facilitation program data, it had well over a million payments. And we know at least $10.5 billion has gone out to farmers.
Farmers where? Give me like the top three states.
The top three states include Illinois, which saw $1.8 billion, and followed closely by Iowa and then Minnesota. But really, every state benefited, you know, from macadamia nut farmers in Hawaii to cotton growers in Georgia. Right. The data, we see it, you know, patterned all across the U.S. But really what lights up when you map this data are the kind of agricultural heartland right down the middle of the country.
Right. They took the biggest economic whack, but it's really difficult to separate the politics out of this, too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. These are very politically important states as well. For example, Minnesota, in the top three states receiving subsidies, it's not lost on us that Minnesota, Trump lost here by less than 3 percentage points.
Yeah.
And, you know, even more broadly speaking, farmers are just a really key political constituency for Trump's reelection hopes and just the Republican Party more broadly.
Can we talk distribution here for a minute? And there's a conversation to be had about average payout versus median payout. Discuss that for me, would you?
Yeah, well, first thing to note is that the data is actually line-by-line payouts. And so if farmers qualified for more than one type of commodity, say they're raising hogs and growing corn, they could get more than one payout, rightfully.
Right.
And so two or three payouts are common in the data. But it's really interesting when we crunch these numbers, the smallest payout was 33 cents, so less than probably the postage it sent to mail that out. And in fact, there were thousands of payments that were like less than $20. But on the whole, you know, the average payment was about $10,000. But the median, which is the middle of the pack, that was closer to $2,000. So if you think back to your stats class, what that means when the average is so much higher than the middle is that there were a handful of really big payments and then a much greater number of small payments at the bottom.
Right. Thankfully, I never took a stats class. So, you know, thank you for the reminder. Also, it's important to point out here that our reporting shows that these farmers, the ones we talked to anyway, did not recoup their losses from the trade war. That is to say, they had more expenses than payments they got, which is an important thing to note.
Absolutely.
Last item, who got the most money out of this thing?
There's a big keynote or a key footnote, I should say, about this data, which is that there aren't limits to the number of family members or owner operators who could receive these payments. And so even though we might conjure up kind of this notion of the family farmer with dirt under his or her fingernails receiving these payments, in some cases it's people who are living far from the farm but are, quote, actively engaged in farming. And so they're receiving payments for their losses. The largest sum of money went to a place called DeLine Farms, headquartered in Missouri. And they have three legal names under DeLine that are all at the same address. All told, $5.5 million over 15 payments went to that operation. And we also saw more than 60 other farming entities that received payments exceeding $1 million.
Andy Egbert is a senior research associate up at APM Research Lab at the parent company, American Public Media, up in St. Paul. Great stuff on data visualization. Can't recommend it highly enough. You can find it in our Tariff Lands piece at marketplace.org. Andy, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up.
Peel it. Easy to eat. Sweet.
We're talking tangerines, people, but first, we gotta do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 137 today, 0.4%, 28,376. NASDAQ picked up 59.6 tenths percent, 88.87. The S&P 500 crossed the 3,200 mark. It found 14.4 tenths percent, ended at 3,205, record highs all. Drugstore chain Rite Aid soared by 42% today, beat expectations for profits and revenue. Food conglomerate ConAgra jumped more than 15% today. Bonds rose just a touch. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell, but not a whole lot. 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace helps you answer questions you've always wondered about, and now that includes finding out more about how and why we do what we do every day. Become a Marketplace investor today, and you'll get exclusive access to a series of virtual AMAs featuring David Brancaccio, Molly Wood, and me, Kai Ryssdal. Don't miss out on our 2020 Ask Me Anything series. Contribute $60 or sign up to donate $5 a month at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You know, pretty much every year, some group or company does a survey about which college majors people regret picking the most. And pretty much every year, a humanities degree of one variety or another tops the list. And sure enough, in a survey this past summer, ZipRecruiter did the survey. English and foreign languages were number one. And really, the reason's pretty obvious, right? I mean, a degree in, like, theater isn't going to get you a high-paying job at a tech firm. Or will it? Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has the story.
When Amazon launched its virtual assistant, Alexa, the company wasn't thinking about making her funny.
Because she was supposed to be more like the computer on Star Trek.
Amy Jimenez-Marquez leads the team that designs Alexa's personality.
She was supposed to just be very functional.
Library computer, working.
But users did want Alexa to have a personality. That's why Marquez now has a job that lets her use her degree in directing theater, as well as her 30 years of experience in improv. So, now that Alexa is 5 years old,
we know where she lives. We know her Myers-Briggs personality type.
Alexa lives in the cloud, and she's an extrovert, or an ESFJ, in case you're a Myers-Briggs nerd. And once you know those personality traits, you can figure out how a chatbot might actually converse. That's where the improv skills come in. And Marquez isn't the only comedian doing this.
We'll start with two people. A third person will enter. And I'd say just look to establish our base reality.
Alex French teaches and performs in New York with the improv group Upright Citizens Brigade. That base reality he's talking about to a group of performers, that's a concept known as yes and. It basically means saying yes to your scene partner's decisions and moving them forward. So when French gives the performers a cue,
your suggestion is piano.
They run with it.
I know that I'm a little old to learn, but summer too late.
That's what I always say. It is never too late, Carla. I'm so glad you called me.
I should tell you that I did book a spot at Carnegie Hall. I just needed something to really get me to finally do this.
Improv skills got French his first tech job with a weather forecast chatbot called Poncho. He wrote jokes for the bot, which was a cat.
Poncho was very lazy overall, liked pizza.
Poncho, which is no longer active, had a group of comedians behind it. French said working there felt like being in a writer's room. The team would workshop jokes and think about what the character might do. They scripted how Poncho would respond to certain trigger words.
Like, maybe we have it set that anytime someone mentions pizza, they're going to get this specific response. Pizza in all caps with, like, an emoji with a tongue sticking out.
But chatbots are becoming more sophisticated. And customer service or retail bots that are trying to complete a transaction, they need to be able to converse in a way that keeps you talking. So if you say pizza to one of them, it needs to be able to say, yes, pizza, and do you want to make one or order one? It's even more complicated when human emotions are involved. Elena Scopetos has a background in theater and improv. Google recruited her to work on its voice assistant.
I think my acting background really helped me find the emotional core of the assistant.
Like what the assistant should say when someone says to it, I'm sad.
I think one of the answers we have is something like,
I wish I had arms so I could give you a hug, but for now maybe a joke or some music might help.
Companies want their bots to connect with users because they want people to keep interacting with them. Kathy Pearl works in conversation design at Google. She says, yeah, a voice assistant could respond the same way each time.
But you don't want to hear the exact same thing every single time you might ask the same question. So somebody with a more creative background might think of a variety of different ways to respond to the same question. So it's not just the same thing over and over.
As the technology behind chatbots advances, there could be lots more work like this.
If you think about the stage at which machines are today, it's not even of a toddler's communication exchange.
Rupal Patel is a professor of computer and information sciences at Northeastern University. She also runs her own text-to-speech startup. She says a lot of our exchanges with bots still feel pretty canned, and the companies want to move beyond that.
That's really what designers are trying to get at in terms of hiring people with these kinds of other talents, is trying to figure out, well, how do we do this that it feels more in the moment and natural?
Essentially, how do we get a machine to improvise? In New York, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We're going to take a detour to the citrus aisle now to one particular fruit, tangerines. Why? Well, because one of our listeners was wondering about them. That's why. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman with this installment of our series, I've Always Wondered.
Marketplace listener Rick Peters, who is 73, shared this memory.
When I was growing up, it was always a treat around the holiday season to get these small oranges, kind of nicely packaged, nested in the box, and fairly pricey.
Peters says that sweet nostalgia has turned a bit sour lately. His discount grocer sells 5-pound bags of seedless tangerines year-round. Cheap, sometimes tasteless and tough, and he wants to know
how this went from being sort of a specialized item at the holidays to something that are kind of like a dime a dozen.
Let's start with the science of seedless tangerines, sometimes called mandarins or clementines.
There's the genus Citrus, subfamily the Aurantioidae, which is in the plant family called Rutaceae.
Botanist Tracy Kahn at UC Riverside in the heart of California's citrus country manages a collection of more than 1,000 citrus trees that help trace the origins of today's seedless tangerine varieties.
Citrus originated in Southeast Asia. The Yunnan province of China is thought to be the seat of domestication.
That was sometime in the Paleolithic era. Fast forward to the mid-1800s, when a small orange variety with seeds was being grown in Morocco and shipped to the U.S.
Tangerine is a term that was coined from brightly colored sweet mandarins that shipped to Florida from the port of Tangiers.
Throughout the 20th century, most of our tangerines, the ones in those fancy holiday boxes, still came from Spain and North Africa. In California, where most eating oranges are grown, Sunkist, the big growers co-op, favored navel oranges, which have a long growing and selling season. This is UC Davis ag economist Dan Sumner.
For many years, they resisted the move towards the seedless, easy peel tangerines. Turns out they were wrong.
Those tangerines were getting more and more popular. Some rebel California citrus farmers started growing them in the 1990s, marketed under the Little Cuties brand, and they took off. Today, about a quarter of California's groves are planted in tangerines. It's a $300 to $400 million crop that supplies the U.S. market from fall to spring. At New Seasons Grocery in Portland, Oregon, around half the citrus for sale right now is seedless tangerines. Produce manager Jeff Fairchild thinks that'll grow.
People want to buy fruit they can eat in their car or things that don't get their hands dirty. And I think that's one of the real appeals with more of the tangerines that are a little puffier, peel it, easy to eat, sweet.
So how do you account for our listener Rick Peters' experience? Remember, he complained that the bagged tangerines he gets year-round are sometimes bland or chewy, neither easy to peel nor totally seedless. Ag economist Dan Sumner points out they may be coming from abroad, out of storage, or out of season.
I think people who don't remember seasons, they don't know that there's a few weeks out of the year where the peaches actually taste like peaches.
and fresh seedless tangerines burst in your mouth, dribbling juice down your chin. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we started with the Federal Reserve. We will end with the Fed. This one is for the folks who say, come on, what do I care about what the Fed does? Well, in addition to interest rates, which you should definitely care about, and a bunch of other things, the Fed is a clearinghouse of sorts for a whole lot of financial transactions, including direct deposits, which is why you might be interested to hear that there was a glitch in that system today. A couple hours, everything's fine now, but could have been ugly. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 137 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 59 points, that is 0.6%. S&P 500 found 14 points, 0.4% above 3,200. All of those, again, record highs. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, and Heron Bikella are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.